Hi and welcome to the Verity La Poetry Podcast. I'm Alice Allen. Every month I'll be interviewing a poet who's been published in the journal. We'll discuss their poem and also ask them to bring along a poem from another poet that they admire. Today I'm joined by Verity La's managing editor, Michelle Seminara, and together we'll be talking with guest poet, Philip Hall. Hi guys.
How are you going?
Good.
Hi Alice.
Hi. So as well as being a contributor to Verity La, Philip is a project editor and mentor for our Emerging Indigenous Writers Program. He's also the author of Sweetened in Coals, published by Ginninderra Press in 2014, and Diwuruwara, published by Black Rune Press in 2015. And some of the poems from that collection have just been published on Verity La. And Philip is also a poetry reader for Overland and a critic who's written for publications such as Cordite and Plumwood Mountain. It's lovely to have you with us today, Philip.
Thank you.
So why don't we start with, I wanted to hear about what your day-to-day work looks like with the Borroloola Poetry Club and the collaborative writing process that you run there. And apologies in advance for my pronunciation of Indigenous words.
All's good. Well, I went to live in Borroloola in 2011, and I went to work there as a teacher of sport and camp programs, really aimed at re-engaging the kids in school attendance and teaching a little bit about cooperative group learning and emotional resiliency and that sort of thing. And unfortunately, I left Borroloola at the end of 2015, and I now live in Melbourne. So I'm a little bit removed from the Borroloola Poetry Club at the moment, but I was obviously very involved in it for the 5 years that I was in Borroloola.
Okay, so you went there not necessarily as a poet, but did that project kind of emerge over your time there?
Yeah. I went to Borroloola as a teacher, but my job was particularly to coach sport, to run sport programs, and to run camp programs. So take the kids out to give them opportunities to play sport against other towns and that sort of thing. Borroloola is in the Gulf of Carpentaria, so it's extremely remote. Our nearest supermarket or nearest town was 800 kilometres away in Katherine, and Darwin was almost 1,000 kilometres away.
Wow, that's amazing.
So to give the kids an opportunity to have a game of sport, you had to put them in a bus and drive a minimum 700 kilometres each way. So basically, and every time you wanted to give the kids a game of sport, it involved running a camp because of the distances involved. So that's what my life was. I was coaching sport, running camps, and on Friday afternoon, I'm not even sure how it all began, but on Friday afternoon, I think it was partly initiated by the kids, we started running the poetry club. So when school finished Friday afternoon, we would organise afternoon tea. The kids would have afternoon tea under the mango tree. And then we would go in and have a very raucous poetry club for a couple of hours before I drove everyone home.
A raucous
poetry club.
It was very raucous, yeah.
That sounds great. what were some of the highlights? Can you remember any particular moments when it felt like everything came together and something clicked between yourself and the students?
Oh, yeah, well, the beautiful thing about the poetry club is we were just trying to create a space that was safe and that the kids just enjoy coming to. So obviously it was after school, so no one had to come. Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on which way you look at it, you know, we often got up to about 50 kids. So it was one of the reasons why it was very raucous, because we often had so many kids involved. The kids just loved it. It was, as much as anything, it was about storytelling. So after afternoon tea, the kids would tell a story about culture. And so all the kids would join in as the story grew and gathered its own pace and momentum. And this was made more complicated because Borroloola was made up of four different tribal groups. So each kids came from four different tribal groups. So they all had their own stories and their own slants on commonalities, if you like. And so what we tried to do was amalgam these together. Or maybe some weeks we would choose a particular story. So we might have a particular week where we did a Yunyuwa story, or the next week a Gawa, or et cetera. And the kids would tell a story. We would try and capture it in words, laughing about my impossible mispronunciations of Aboriginal English or Creole and language. And then eventually we'd get to the stage where we'd start putting some words on a whiteboard, and we'd go over it then, and I would read back to the kids what we'd got, and we'd look at it there. And so it was really about the kids, empowering the kids to share their stories and to feel confident and happy.
That's amazing. I love to hear that, Philip. I was really interested in when I was reading your little chapbook, which is a collection of poetry from the Gulf of Carpentaria by Blancroon Press, and there was a lot of, as you say, Creole or sort of Aboriginal slash English language in there. How did it come about that you started to write that way? Is that something you've seen done a lot before? Is that just something that came naturally to you and to the poetry club?
It was simply my attempt to write what the kids were saying. That was how the kids talked. Mm.
It's quite phonetic, isn't it? Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, Borroloola has a very sad contact history. From about the 1860s, Borroloola was a thoroughfare for the cattle industry as stock went up through northern Queensland and then through the Gulf and all of the big stations in the Territory and in the Kimberley. Every cattle that was that stocked those stations went through Borroloola, both to the stations and from the stations back to markets. So Borroloola has a terribly sad history of massacre, of dispossession, and it goes right back to the 1860s. So unlike places like the Kimberley or the Cape York or Arnhem Land that missed a lot of that earliest, most violent contact history because they are a little bit more distant and physically isolated, Borroloola was this thoroughfare. So all of the people around Borroloola were completely dispossessed. They were all forced to live together in the town as they were driven off their own tribal lands. So Borroloola, in the dry season, Borroloola was about 600 to 700 people. And in the wet season, as people were flooded into the town, it grew to often about 1,200, 1,300. And most of the people from Borroloola were made up of the Gadangi, Mara, Gurra and Yunyua people.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the traditional owners of Borroloola were actually completely massacred before 1900. Mm-hmm. So the land that Borroloola now is on became part of the traditional lands of the Yunyua people.
Mm. Yeah, it must have been, from the reading the poems, there's so much joy there, but there's also obviously so much trauma there as well. I noticed in your bio you were saying, you know, you've been adopted in a sense into the Gadangi family, and I'm wondering if you could explain to us how that trust and relationship built up over time.
Sure. Well, I went there in 2011 and I'd worked there for a couple of years. Before early 2013, I was working in the secondary school coaching sport, just doing my normal work. And I guess because I was seen as someone, I was lucky because I was often teaching the kids out of the classroom. So I saw the best of the kids on the sporting field and out bush and camp and all of that. And one of the elders of the Gadangi tribe, a lady called Adie Miller, she just saw something in me that, she obviously recognised the closeness and the emotional intimacy I had with the kids, I guess, and the relationship that I'd built with them. And she told me that she wanted to make me part of her family. So she gave me a skin name, and that defines your relationships with people and with country. And then she also gave me my bush name, which is Jijindaraji, which was the traditional or bush name of her pop. So she wanted me to have that.
That's quite an honour, I imagine.
Yeah, it blew me away. It was, I think it's probably the proudest thing that's ever happened to me, apart from my own family and that sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah. And there's a beautiful poem you've got in Sweetening Coals dedicated to her as well, isn't there?
Yeah. Yeah, the new book that I'm writing called Fume, it has a lot of poems about the Miller and Raggett mob, who were the main Gadangi people from the Gulf.
It's an amazing story. I'm wondering if we should move now into your poem that's published on Verity La Concourse.
Sure.
Yeah, exactly as Michelle said, there's so much joy in this poem, but there is definitely an undercurrent of something else. So I'm looking forward to hearing you read it.
Sure. Mum, would you like me to read it right now?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, concourse for the Borroloola mob. In my troopie, dodging dogs, ditches, and broken bikes, I'm at a camp of concrete blocks, crushed soft drink cans, and verandas strewn with mattresses. Here, each building's bound to a street front, white and blue steel sign, a corporatized prescription, no liquor, no pornography, and scratched Mununga on you. Hey, Jigger! Mabu leans in close. Let's get them young ones bush. Our complement of kids forearmed, their gear crammed into garbage bags. We take to the crossing, a bridge built to span flooding waters and golden middens of Forex cans. In these footings, Mabu discerns disturbance. That bridge wrong way, dizzy Warralunku, hill kangaroo dreaming, and them spirit fellas stir strife. But we're soon bumping along savanna plains, past darkly skeletal eucalypts and the diamond desolated trunks of cycads and pandanus with their crowns of palm fronds, and Malbu waves me on. Paper bark, a brolga dreamin', directly Millard River will sing. Behind us, the kids laugh animated, stirring and teasing in and out of their seats, their hands and eyes and mouths a liquid warbling, only partly accessible to me, though I know they want the music changed. As Malbu growls, "You mob got worms or what? Get your black bunyi sitting and sit down. This blackfella, William Barton's didgeon. You show some respect now. Look here, mister, stop that way." The boys peering at the window are silenced as Malbu agrees to twin trees. Might be something. You know, big business. Dem old people watching. Dis big Coojigger, and he comes kicking against the pricks all through here. So with our kids behind me, tracing their fingers on my white fella skin and Malbu's arm round my shoulder, I lean into country. A pair of slender messmate trees with darkly scarred trunks, a daredevil didger's drum fire. Rounding a bend in the gravel road, the kids are chiking and hooting camp. Malbu allocates jobs and I recce an abseil site, pondering my eco spiel as they cut down a 3 meter cypress pine. No, mister, he burned bright, smoked dem mozzie too, and soon you dig tattle with us mob. In em dry swamp, Malbu assures me, "Jigger, this bush tucker make Millard mob blackfella shiny and strong, and we do it all proper law way. Everything's into song." Later, downstream from cast nets and hand lines, I'm watching flows at the river's confluence. A red and brown twin load swirling suspended. "Look here, mister, tubular running one." True God, we really are an arterial kaleidoscope of silt-laden language.
Wow, that's incredible. I remember, Philip, when this poem dropped into the Verity La inbox, submissions inbox, and Stuart Barnes was the poetry editor with me at that time, and we both were just like, oh my gosh, it's an incredible poem. Yes, we must publish this one. And I still feel the same when I was rereading it today. It gave me tingles.
Yeah, it's like being inside the experience. You really feel very involved in what's happening, especially hearing you read it out loud, but even when you're reading it on the page, it's incredibly engaging. I was wondering about the process of writing it and whether it was something that came quite quickly or whether it was something that you worked on over a long period of time.
No, I write very slowly. I normally write one thing at a time because I'm a little bit obsessive, I suppose. So I need to finish something before I can start the next project, which is frustrating. But I tend to write very slowly and go through a lot of revisions and editing.
I think that's a good way to be. You can tell that there's so much precision and care being put into every single line, but somehow you've managed to retain this natural and conversational quality as well. So there's an amazing balance happening. I guess that's
happening. Yeah, like listening to the kids talk, you know, it really did take a couple of years to really tune your ear to it and to be able to, and it's still an approximation, like it's not exact, but it's my best attempt to approximate and to celebrate the way the kids actually talk.
Yeah, I think that's what really struck me about this poem. It is such a celebration, you know, which is beautiful. It's just so joyful.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's a joyfulness and a language that, being suburbanites, you know, we don't often get to hear. I don't often get to hear this kind of language at all. So it's a wonderful window into that world, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, it's an attempt to celebrate the language and what has remained strong despite the shocking contact history. And it's hard for the kids because, you know, the older people, like, as I said, all the people have been dispossessed. So in a sense, the people have been robbed of their language also, because you've got four tribes living in one small town, very, very isolated. And to talk to each other, of course, they have to get some language that everyone shares in common. So Creole is a natural language to arise.
That's very interesting.
That further leads to a loss of language and a loss of culture, of course, but Creole is incredibly dynamic, and I've wanted to celebrate what has remained strong.
And has there been a lot of conflict between the people who moved in to Borroloola as well as the people who moved through?
Between white and black, or?
Well, I guess between the communities. So you said there are four main communities that were living there.
Yeah.
Is it a fairly how do they interact with one another?
The kids would describe Borroloola as a fighting town.
Right.
But that's, you know, it's about dispossession, it's about disadvantage and living with trauma and all of those sort of things. It's a place where there is huge trauma.
Did you find, Philip, that the people who were drawn to the poetry club perhaps found that form of self-expression quite a cathartic or healing experience? Or,
Well, hopefully empowering, in the sense that, you know, they knew that I really treasured what they had to say, and I loved their stories and I couldn't get enough of them, and I wanted to celebrate those stories and their language. So to that extent, I hope they picked up that celebratory tone, sure. Like kids are kids, you know, like they just want afternoon tea and make noise and share stories and make sure that they get the attention. So it was... The poetry club was fantastic. It was a raucous, happy celebration of story and culture.
I think it's such a fabulous thing that, you know, there's not much poetry, I suppose, in the Western sort of tradition that is collaborative in a sense. And it's a very natural thing, it seems, in Indigenous communities for different artistic expressions to be a collaborative expression rather than individual expression. And I found that really fascinating and also really exciting when I was reading some of these poems.
Yeah, absolutely. The collaborative part was very much, they're very important. Ironically, of course, because it is also quite a traditional society, it was really important. Once the kids started telling you stories and you started to write them down, it was really important to get permission from the right people to retell that story, because of the loss of culture and the very fractious contact history, there is a lot of protection about culture. There's a lot of holding on to culture, and people can be very suspicious of what you're trying to do. So it was also part of the process was a very difficult, often, process of getting permission to tell certain stories as well. Although, of course, because the kids were telling you, in a sense, they were enabling and giving you permission. But depending on what the story was, you know, like, for example, to call the poetry club Dualla Wallaroo, we had to get permission from the traditional owners of that cultural word to use the word for the poetry club. And that was an interesting process, getting that permission as well.
Yeah, but I suppose very, very important in building up a level of trust.
Yeah, absolutely.
Philip, why don't we move on to the poem that you've brought to discuss with us today?
Yeah.
And I think you were saying earlier that this is the first time you've had a chance to talk about this poem in a public forum. So
that's it's really my exciting. First time to declare my love.
That's so great.
Yeah, well, this is a poem called Inheritance by Dorothy Hewitt. I think it is probably my favourite poem. You know, it's not a big, ambitious poem like Paradise Lost by Milton or something like that. It's a small little poem under 20 lines. It's modest of intent, but it's just a poem that is a remarkable celebration of what we receive from our own culture and from our own relatives, our ancestors, and a way of celebrating what has gone before and that sort of family history. I just love the way she receives.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I must admit my ignorance. I haven't read this poem until you emailed me and said, I'd like to talk about this one. I read it and I was like, oh, that's magnificent. I love it.
Oh, look, it's incredible. And Dorothy Hewitt, you know, she's such an experimenter and such a bold, dynamic presence. The way it's, as I said, on one hand, the poem seems to be very modest, very quiet, very calm. But when you start looking at the poem, there's no traditional punctuation in it. It's almost like, you know, the poem is a celebration of time and the passing of time, and punctuation, traditional punctuation at least, is unable to control the flow of words on the page in the same way that we are unable to control that flow of language. And I just love the way Dorothy Hewitt has brought that form and feeling together so perfectly.
Yeah, I was struck by that as well when I was reading it. You know, the syntax and the lack of punctuation really propels the reader forward in the way that life propels us forward, you know. So yeah, as much absolutely. As we'd maybe like to look back, there's not much time to, it's on to the next thing, and then she pushes you, you know, to that amazing ending of the poem. It's just fabulous.
Absolutely. All right. Inheritance by Dorothy Hewitt. I have travelled a long way from my origins. Is there anything left of the child with the wheaten hair who listened for hours, loved poetry and winter fires, remembered the strange moment in the dark fields when the pet lambs grown into ewes and wethers trotted along the fence lines, bleating to be let in? You can never go back, only onwards. Into the world, leaving behind all the loved things, the grandfather flying on his wing nag through the frosty paddocks, the handsome father haloed in sparks, roasting spuds in the ashes of the playroom fire. Where do you go from there, concealed in darkness, glowing with the heat in the grass, the hawk in the wood, the plovers spinning of spring in front of the plough, to the old woman watching for her bulbs to come up, the irises lining the path, the white cockatoos in a flurry of wings, a visitation of angels.
Such an amazing poem. I'm so glad you brought it. I hadn't read it either, so it's wonderful to encounter this.
I love Hewitt, and I'm pretty sure that's my favourite one.
It's so I'm so glad you had that discussion earlier about the way that punctuation works in this poem as well, because I was relatively confused by it, I suppose. I thought, why are there no full stops? What's happening? But it makes a lot of sense now that you've explained this is about time passing and it's about a lack of control. But I love the thing I loved about it was that she only asks the question. She's saying, "Where do you go?" As if the things that she's remembering are in the depths of the past and there's nothing to replace them with. She just puts that question out there, "Where do you go from here?"
Yeah, sure.
And I don't think I'll ever look at cockatoos the same way again.
Yeah, she's a gorgeous, such a visual writer. She's just so evocative, dynamic.
Do you remember when you first came into contact with her writing or with this poem?
Oh, I've been reading Dorothy Hewitt for at least 20 years. I think I probably read a lot of her poetry at least every year. But that one I particularly return to. I guess because I also came from a very close, very big family, so I really just love that celebration of family and to have just such a remarkable poem. It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, there's a celebratory element in the way that she talks about her father and her grandfather, but do you think there's a sadness in it as well, or am I just projecting that on?
I know, I'm sure there is. Like, there is a sadness, isn't there, about the passing? Like, even when old people pass, it's sad. So there is a sadness, I think, a sense of eulogy about the poem, I guess. And you can't have those memories back, can you? You know, memories are a great thing, but in a sense, they don't make up for the actual experience when you lived through it at the time. Doesn't offer any easy consolation, does it?
No, not at all. And that's why I like it, is because it leaves things kind of hanging and unanswered. What did you think of it, Michelle, hearing it read?
I love the way Philip reads, number one. He's a fabulous reader. The main thing I was struck with was that forward movement. And it felt quite sort of intense and inevitable, and it kind of brought on a sense of nostalgia for me. You know, that continual forward movement, it's life pushing you on, and before you know it, another year's gone, another year's gone. And that idea that where is that time in between gone? Suddenly you're an old woman, and yet those memories are still really vivid, and you think, you know, what happened in that space in between? It's very, I think it's something that as you age, you can very much relate to. And I found it quite sort of poignant and sad and very nostalgic in a way.
Yeah, and it's just the beautiful simplicity of the title as well, isn't it? Just that incredible confidence that Dorothy Hewitt had in just such simplicity and the modest, calm intent.
Yes, even though the poem has a lot of forward motion, it is calm. It's not rushed. It's not sort of frantic. It is a calm and measured poem in many ways.
Yeah, it's a beautiful piece of writing.
Absolutely.
Philip, can I ask you about the way that your work is received differently by the different communities that you have contact with? Because it sounds very much like the last, your recent life has involved straddling a number of communities, and I'm wondering how your poetry tends to be received by them.
Well, I guess I'm like any emerging poet, for want of a better word. You never really know how your stuff is being received, do you? I don't think. You know, you can read certain reviews of books, but until you're established, you never receive a lot of reviews. And in I've had some mental health issues of late, so when I have been invited to attend certain festivals and stuff, I have been over the last 12 months been saying no. So I've sort of isolated myself a little bit at home, I guess. So that's a difficult question for me to answer, I think, just at the moment.
No, that's fair enough. I know what you mean. It's always a bit of a guessing game, really.
There's a bit of a silence, isn't there? You publish a book and then There's, you know, crickets, crickets. There's really nothing. You're just not quite sure.
Nope. And yeah, I've started trying to write myself back to health. I've just sit at home quietly all day writing. And for me, the blessing of the last 12 months, views and essays, because it's just taken the pressure off having to come up with ideas for poems. And the poem, you know, my bread and butter is just, you know, what I do every day is just get up to do reviews. And I can worry about the poetry when something, you know, interesting catches my
Something.
fancy to write something.
Yeah. Well, you are very prolific with reviews, I've noticed, and essays. I think you know, it's amazing. You've got wonderful insights there, and but I know what you mean. Poems are something that have to sort of push up a little bit more spontaneously, harder to
Yeah,
conjure.
I'd hate to wake up every morning with the pressure of having to write a new poem. Otherwise, I'd feel like I'd been completely unproductive that day. I think I would be going mad if that was the case. The review writing I've been fantastic for me.
So, Philip, when you left Borroloola, it was, I think, because you were having some issues there. Do you mind speaking about that at all,
Yeah, no, I can speak a little bit.
or? Because the trauma of the place was quite intense, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I got too involved, too close. I guess in part the job meant too much to me. It had been my lifelong dream to do remote Indigenous education, and I got married to Gillian very young, and we started having children straight away. So the deal always was, obviously, you know, we wanted to wait till our kids grew up and before we did that really big thing of going remote or so remote. So when our kids all were adults, that was the chance to do it, and the job just sort of became available. So I went up there in 2011, and then Gillian followed me in 2012, and then we were there. So partly the problem was that the job meant too much to me, so I could be very easily I overworked, I threw myself into too much, I was trying to do too much. I have a over anxious, over ambitious Christ complex at the best of times, and Borroloola magnified that particular thing. So it was very like I initiated a lot of work. I initiated lots of projects, which were fantastic. The community loved it. The kids loved it. But of course, it didn't always go
Takes its
down well.
toll.
Well, yeah, and it didn't always go down well with school executive. And so I could be very easily bullied and undermined. So there was just a lot of things that all happened, and I found the trauma. After 5 years of I just inhaled so much trauma. It was really like, I actually, in Darwin recently, I went to the Ben Quilty exhibition after Afghanistan. And I remember going into the exhibition, I'd actually just been out of Borroloola at hospital, and I was out living in the gardens, botanical gardens in the middle of Darwin after I just got out of hospital. And I went to that exhibition, and I really just broke down because what I was seeing on was Ben Quilty painting that trauma, and the trauma that was just stripped and unpackaged of those soldiers. I guess that's what I saw in myself, and it was a type of lived trauma, and I guess I just breathed too much in. So I had a
I think it would be hard not to, though.
Yeah, well, some people do things better. And it's better if you do things better because then you're still there working for the community and the kids, and you're still doing good work and instead of being very indulged staying at home. But yeah, that's.
It's not an uncommon thing, though. I've definitely met a number of people who have taken on responsibilities like that, you know, working in disaster zones and things like that. And I think there's a limit, and I think that's okay.
Yeah.
Have you found, Philip, you say you've been, you know, your writing has been such a big help with that, sort of writing through that trauma and from that trauma. Is that something that you do with your poetry?
Yeah, absolutely. Some of the poems in Fume, if the book gets published, I had a residency in Darwin from the Northern Territory Writers' Centre, and part of the deal was at the end we had to read some poems, and they really wanted me to read some of the poems that I'd actually written while I was on the residency, and I was reflecting fairly deeply about what had happened in Borroloola, I guess, and I found at that point it was too much to read those poems. I wasn't able to get through. So I enjoy writing them, and I don't mind sending them out to get published and other people can read them. That's all good. But whether I'll get to the stage where I can read them in public, I'm not sure. We'll see.
It's amazing. It's only a manuscript so far at Fume. Still looking for a publisher, I know, for that one. But I was very honoured when you sent me the manuscript to have a little sneak preview of, and it's an absolutely amazing, you know, selection of poems. I can't wait to see it published, actually.
Yeah, hopefully sometime next year. We'll see. It would be good for me to mean I could move on a little bit. And I was really lucky after my breakdown. As I said, my wife handled things much better than me. Gillian is so calm and she's much more dependent. So we were still able to live in Borroloola, which is fantastic because she was still working at the school. So I had the last year back in Borroloola. So at least I didn't have my big crash and then sort of just get airlifted out and never be able to go back to the place. So it was good to have that last year in the town and just be able to have a year just to be with people and family and friends in Borroloola, and to, you know, the Bardi Bardi took me out bush to collect bush medicine, and it was just wonderful to be cared for and to be so loved and cared for by the Aboriginal people of Borroloola. That was special. It was a really lovely year, and I will keep returning to the Gulf and to Borroloola. You know, it's very hard to get to just because of distance, but I will keep going back there with family and friends, and I still have a lot of Facebook and I ring people all the time.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Philip, just as a last question for you, I know that through your work with Plumwood Mountain that you do some writing in the world of eco-poetics. And for those of us who are perhaps not as familiar with the world of eco-poetics, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you understand that term and the writing that you do in that area.
Yeah, sure. Nature poetry, I think when you start reading a lot of poetry, it's remarkable how many poets mine the natural world for much of their imagery. And I guess for me, there's sort of three types of nature poetry. There's a nature poetry of praise, where the poet often has the natural world, the non-human world, as their subject, and they're often praising that. So whether they're from a mountain lookout praising a national park, or, you know, whether they're in a backyard, like that beautiful Bruce Dorr poem, Homo Suburbiensis, when he's out in the backyard just in almost rapture of his vegetable garden. That's another absolutely beautiful poem that I love. So, that, you know, there's a real poetry of praise. There's a poetry of almost called image, where the poet is using imagery from the natural world but to explore human concerns, whether that be old age or bereavement or, you know, loss of one thing or another, cancer, all sorts of things. And then there's so that's the poetry where it's not nature that's the subject, but humans are the subject, and nature's being used to explore human concerns. And then there's a nature poetry of dwelling, where it's the relationship between people and nature that is the subject, and it's our ability to dwell in nature, that beautiful Thoreau word of dwelling. It goes back to Heidegger as well. And I think that's what eco-poetics is for me. Eco-poems are poems that They're not just nature poems. They're poems that really are exploring the relationship between people and nature and the ability of people to dwell in nature in an equitable, just way.
I'm definitely going to have to go and look those up. They sound like fantastic poems to start with.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. And eco-poetics, like Plumwood Mountain, the journal is dedicated to eco-poetics. Eco-poetics, I guess, is a real movement. Like, it's been going for a long time, of course, but it really got a lot of momentum in the US in the early 1990s, and particularly in electronic journal form. There's quite a few journals in America that specialize in eco-poetics, and you've got wonderful poets like Robert Wrigley and A.R. Ammons, and, you know, there's all sorts of poets. So it's hardly surprising that Australia has also caught the bug, if you like, and there's a lot of eco-poetics in Australia. My particular slant, my particular emphasis is to bring a post-colonial contact with that eco-poetic concern. Because for me, it's not enough just to explore the relationship between nature and people and to celebrate and to want to point out where things are going amiss, like with climate change. For me, it's absolutely foundational that that has to be done from a post-colonial point of view. And for me personally, the Indigenous presence and Indigenous custodianship always has to be at the foundation of any study of eco-poetics.
Yeah, that makes complete sense to me as well.
Yeah. So I would say, for example, that, you know, the concept of wilderness is a racist concept, particularly in the sense of Australia. There is no wilderness in the sense that you have a natural ecosystem that is untouched by people. All of Australia is Indigenous land, and it's all been under the custodianship of Indigenous people. And whether it's through fire stick farming or all sorts of other presences and practices and the Indigenous understanding of sacred sites and all that sort of thing, all of the ecosystems in Australia are in some senses human made or certainly human changed. So for me, you know, as an eco poet, the notion of wilderness is quite a racist notion. And it's again, it's another notion that is part of a colonizing, of taking land away from Indigenous people and undermining custodianship of the traditional owners.
That's so fascinating. I must admit, I've never thought about it like that before, but it makes perfect sense, you know, the concept of wilderness, that there is something untouched which sort of suggests that, you know, it will at some time be sort of colonized or touched. But then the idea is just this interdependence between Indigenous people and nature. It's a completely different concept.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, it has a lot of really, there are lots of dilemmas in that sort of understanding too. For example, in Cape York at the moment, where land has been returned to Indigenous people, and then can Indigenous people have the right to, for example, have forestry or mining on land that was national park and considered to be pristine, or from a whitefella point of view, wilderness. So, and that's going all over the Kimberley and Arnhem Land and all sorts of places, of course. So it does have, you know, whether you prioritise the custodianship of First Nations or whether you attempt to, like William Lyons, who is a more militant eco-critic, whether you would prioritise the natural world and say, well, this has to be kept as it is, you know, leave it as it is, that great American catchment of national parks. My own feeling is that the custodianship of First Nations people always has to be prioritised. And, you know, William Lyons would say, I'm human-centric at the expense of the non-human world. And I understand.
Sorry, go on, Philip.
I understand that criticism. It's a quandary. It's a big difficulty. But for me, the custodianship of First Nations has to come first.
I think this sounds like a whole other show. I think, Alice, we need to get Philip back just to talk on eco-poetics. It's amazing, the wealth of knowledge and the wealth of my ignorance. I personally would love to have a whole other podcast with perhaps Philip and yourself chatting to some, you know, eco poets. That would be amazing.
I feel exactly the same. I just am learning so much from hearing you talk, Philip. It's been such a great chat.
It's been lovely. It's been great.
Well, we might let you go, but thank you so much for your time, Philip and Michelle.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Alice. A pleasure. Thank you, Philip.
So tune in next month for the next installment of the Verity Love Poetry Podcast.